Hi, I'm Umushu.
And I'm Lindsay Claiborne, and you're listening to Beyond the Microscope.
Hi everyone, this is Mumu.
And this is Lindsay. Welcome back to Beyond the Microscope. Our guest today is Christy Lenz. She is a research scientist at Promega working on genetics. Christy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the basics, Christy. Tell me a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Oh, how far back do we need to go? So
only as far as you want.
I'm currently a research scientist, so I'm in research and development at Promega, and I'm in the division that works on the genetic identity products, so mainly products that are targeted for forensic labs. I sort of got into this arena because my background is I have a master's of forensic science in biology, which is the DNA side of forensic science, not the chemical or toxicology part. Started with my master's in there, and I've spent about 6 years between two different private laboratories as a forensic scientist at the bench doing casework. And then we decided we needed to move back to Madison, and I decided it would be a good chance to get out of the private sector of forensic science and get back to the research side. So I'm no longer a practicing forensic scientist. Instead, I am making new and exciting products for the forensic community.
I'm going to ask a very basic question because this is not my field. When you say make products, I actually don't know what that means. What kind of products are you making?
So, would you like me to go O.J. Simpson trial on you?
Go for it. I love it. Anything sure. OJ, if it's a white Bronco, I'll take it.
Are there gloves involved?
it's ironic because we do teach courses now. At Promega, there is a subsidiary, or they're affiliated with Promega. It's an educational branch that teaches classes, and we have high schoolers that come in, and they do a unit on forensic science, and my supervisor teaches it, and he comes back every year, and he's more and more shocked because he has these slides that he brings up every year, and there are actual high schoolers now who don't know who O.J. Simpson is.
I was just thinking that. They really don't know who O.J. Simpson is, do they?
And so he uses this as an example, and everyone is just staring at him like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh, I feel so old. Christy, I know. What have you done to me?
I know. So anyway, I can go.
Go for it.
I don't know what audience this is for, but maybe they don't know about O.J. Simpson.
Let's use O.J. Simpson. Let's stick with O.J. Simpson. So, I know him. Mumu knows him. We're good.
So if I were on a stand testifying, which I've only done once, thank goodness.
We'll come back to that story then.
It was an awesome day. So I testified once, and basically what they tell us and teach us in grad school is how to talk to people about what forensic science biology is. And basically everyone has DNA in their cells. And there's little portions of your DNA chromosomes that have these repeat units in them. And it's just, say, so the genetic code is A, C, T, and G. And in some and those four letters are repeated over and over again in your genome in lots of different ways, obviously, however many ways you can put those four letters together. But there are certain segments of your genome that have repeats, say, TTAA, over and over and over again for a stretch. And we've identified these particular parts of your chromosomes, and we, I say, as geneticists, have identified these areas. And what we can do is we can actually make these things called primers, design these primers, which when you put it in a reaction will make a bunch of copies of that same part of your genome. And that's called the polymerase chain reaction. So we design these primers that sit on either side of these regions of your DNA, and they will amplify or make a bunch of copies of that portion. And what we do then is these copies are all tagged, and we have instruments that can detect the tag that is on these fragments, and it can tell you the size. And based on the size, we can tell you how many repeat units you have in that part of your genome. So say your genome is TTAA, and that's repeated 8 times. Then when the instrument detects that, it will tell you, after a lot of steps, that you are an 8 at that particular locus. And because you get a copy from your mom and a copy of your DNA from your dad, there's going to be 2 sets of those in every single cell. So say you got an 8 from your mom, and the other chromosome that you have has 10 of those repeats, then you would be an 8-10 according to our genetic, what we would call your genotype. So you would be an 8-10, and then we figure out how many people in the world, how often you see an 8 and how often you see a 10, and we build up databases, and with those databases we can use statistics to calculate the frequency of the 8 allele and the frequency of the 10 allele, and then you multiply those together and you say, well, what are the chances of picking a random person anywhere in the world who would be both an 8 and a 10? And so once you do that for one locus, it's maybe like 1 in 200. So that's not really great for deciding if you're a murderer or not. But what we're doing is we're making multiplexes. So we're doing more than just one part of your genome. We're looking up, like right now, I just launched a product where there's 27 of those regions that we're looking at. So once you multiply 1 out of 200 and then all the other calculations that you come up with, you multiply those all by each other, and you end up with, usually nowadays, something around 1 in like 23 times the world's population.
So the odds are pretty darn good that you've got the right person.
Pretty darn good. So basically that has how the field of forensic science has advanced, because early on we'd maybe only identified a handful, like maybe 6 of these markers. And so the statistics weren't that great, but they were still better than, ABO blood typing, which they used to do reliably. You know, if you found blood at a crime scene, just is it A, B, O, negative or positive? And you could compare that to your suspect. And, I mean, those odds are not good. And so when you started with maybe 6 regions, you were like, oh, wow, 1 in 2,000, that's pretty impressive. And then even in my time in the field, we've gone from 16, now, like I said, up to 27. So, I mean, we're just adding more and more of these regions.
Factor.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Well, what about siblings or twins? How close of a match do you get for those?
Siblings are going to share roughly 50% of their DNA, because they're, so based on your Mendelian genetics, you have an equal likelihood of inheriting, from each of your parents. So there's 4 options, right? 2 from your mom and 2 from your dad. And so you're going to have a 50% chance that you got the same one of those 2 copies from either parent. So siblings in general, we think are going to share about 50% of their DNA. So we can do paternity. That everyone is aware of, like the Maury Povich show.
Right.
that's a big market in forensic science, is paternity testing. And you can do that with just one parent and a child. You can exclude someone as being the father. Your statistics get better if you have both the mother sample and the father sample. And then we can also determine, and then there's also a lot of interesting back calculations that you can do if you know genetics, inheritance. So you could determine, you could use grandparents sometimes, because those calculations are a little bit different. But again, it goes back to, they would also have to share some portion of their genetic material in order to be considered a grandparent. One of my most interesting cases was, I think there were 3 siblings, and their father had just passed away, and the fourth potential or alleged sibling had shown up at the funeral and claimed that they were also this person's
related.
Yeah, child, and they deserved some of the will, or the money from the
inheritance.
And so these three siblings said, we've never seen you before. We don't believe this. And so we spent time trying to use the three siblings' DNA to try and back calculate what their father's profile could be and determine on that if this fourth sibling could be related. And in that process, we actually found out that genetically speaking, one of the three siblings was not.
Oh, God. Oh, no.
An actual blood sibling. And, and in those situations, you don't know if you're supposed to tell them.
Is there an ethical rule about that? Or is it sort of a, what do you do?
I think we just told them that we couldn't use their sample for our calculations, but I don't think that we necessarily wanted to let them know. I didn't think that was our right.
Right. Well, that's not what they were asking, right?
Correct. That correct.
What was the result for the fourth alleged sibling?
I don't remember now. I know this was my first job, so I wasn't working on the case at the time. I just remember being there, but I don't think they were related, and I think that part of that was having to exclude the one sibling that wasn't an actual.
Oh, wow.
And because they were throwing off the calculations for, wait a minute, this isn't adding up.
Oh, wow, that's really cool. Well, I know we're talking about your old job, and we'll get to your new job in a little bit, but talk to us a little bit about casework. You said you were in a courtroom once. Those of us who watch CSI
and Bones
and every other crime show out there have one perception of how DNA works and how courtroom dramas work and all that stuff. Tell us if it's all terribly, terribly wrong, or if there's some similarities, or you know what your experiences are like.
I feel like I started in my field at the bad time, because CSI had just come out when I was, I believe, in college, right?
Sounds about right. Yeah.
And I'd already decided that this was what I wanted to do. And I was already taking classes to get where I wanted to go. And all of a sudden, it's called the CSI effect. So as soon as CSI came out, there were thousands of people who said, I want to do that. That's my career. And so all of us who were serious about it were kind of annoyed at the volume of people.
We were here first.
Yes, that all of a sudden wanted to join on the bandwagon that really hadn't been popular until CSI came along. So we were a little, I think, jealous of all the attention that all these other people were getting. Because my program, I went to Michigan State, and there were There were six of us in my class. So each year, I mean, only six people got admitted to the forensics master's program for biology. So if you think about, you know, the thousands of people who all of a sudden wanted to become forensic scientists, they didn't have all the required coursework.
Tell us about your first case and what it was like doing that. And obviously you don't do it anymore. But what was it like, and was it like Law and Order? And can I play the Law and Order background music?
No, I don't think we can afford the rights
to that. Oh, we can afford the rights to that one, that's right.
So it's much different than people think on the TV shows. I mean, aside from the fact that we don't carry guns, maybe if you worked in LA or somewhere scary, I don't know, maybe they give you
still
guns nowadays.
Still probably not.
So we aren't gun-toting. We all sit back and laugh at the, you know, they get a sample in, and within an hour they have the DNA profile, and then they just enter it into a computer and it pops up this person's driver's license picture, and then we can go arrest that person. that's not how our job works typically. So the workflow is more along the lines of, I would say, you have to do the initial cataloging of the sample. So you're doing inventory. So you're assessing what it is that you have and you're documenting. It's a lot of documentation of how is it sealed? You know, is it sealed properly? Did someone initial and date the seal on the evidence? Is there tamper evident tape on there? Because if there's no tape, then you could say, well, it wasn't sealed. So I don't know who's been in and out of this, who's touched this item. It could have been contaminated, and I would have no, me as an analyst receiving this in the lab, I can't tell you if someone else has touched that or not.
Right, you're not the one going and scraping the DNA off the wall and then walking into the lab and then processing it and then...
Correct.
It, you know, it doesn't, it's, you're not the only one who's ever touched it, ever. In fact,
right.
You have no idea who's touched it, right?
Correct. And, I mean, the police officers are the ones who are generally out there collecting the evidence, and so all we get is sometimes it's an envelope with a swab in it, and you know, like a Q-tip swab, and the swab may have some sort of stain on it, and so then this is, so all the information you have is, okay, so I have this envelope here, it's sealed with some tape, it's got some person's initials and the date on it, and the front of the envelope says rear door window. And so that's all the information you have, and then you open the evidence and you have to document what is inside that envelope. And a lot of times you'll just say, if it's a swab, you know, something, you'll say one cotton swab, and you'll say bearing, you know, brownish staining over 50% of the swab. And then generally you're not allowed to consume. So we can only consume 50% of what's there. So then you would say consume 50% of the swab. So this whole documentation process can take a while, depending also if you're going to be doing serology on it. So if they want to know, is this blood? Is this urine? We can do tests for those things, but those will take more time. But if they don't want you to do any of those and they just want to know if there's DNA in that sample, then you would skip that and go straight to your DNA. So then you're doing an extraction, which generally has an overnight incubation. Then you're doing the actual extracting process in the lab the next day, which is going to take you a few hours. Then you're going to be setting up your quant, which is going to be the way we determine whether or not there's DNA present and how much. So it can actually tell you the quantity or the relative quantity of DNA in that sample. And once you have your quant, which takes about an hour to set up, an hour to run, then you're going to use that value to set up your PCR reaction, which is where I come in right now, where I'm working on the kits that do the STR analysis or the short tandem repeat analysis that I was talking about earlier, determining the 8 versus the 10. So then you're going to set up that reaction, and that's going to run for about an hour. And then you're going to have to load that sample on the electrophoresis machine, which is going to detect those fragments and separate them. And then you're going to analyze your data. And then you might know what, maybe, if you can get a full profile. Because sometimes, even if you can detect the presence of DNA, you're not guaranteed that the DNA is intact enough to actually amplify the sizes that you need. So say it's been on, you know, it's a blood stain that was on a car that was sitting in the LA sun for a month before you got to it. That DNA, the UV from the sun is going to work on that DNA and it's going to break it down. And so what may look like a promising sample, when you actually amplify it, could be basically garbage. So that whole process is probably about 2 days. So a lot longer than CSI can show you in 45
minutes. And that's one sample that may or may not help you.
Correct, correct.
And they go through like, well, we had 7 samples and only one of them worked. You're like, well, that would have been 3 weeks, okay?
Yeah, or they'll process a whole house. And police nowadays, because of CSI, we also call it the CSI effect, that police think, and I'm not trying to rag on police officers, but they will collect everything. I mean, it'll be a house, and we'll get swabs from every single doorknob, every single thing that they can think of, because they saw it on CSI, and they got the profile of the person off of that thing. But the reality is, when you're working for a state, which I wasn't, I was working for private labs, but a lot of states have very tight budgets. And if they get a room full of evidence from one case, they're not going to be able to process every single item of evidence and look for DNA. It's not in their budget. I mean, that would take an analyst months to go through. So
just for one thing that may or may not have anything on it at all.
Correct. Or, and in even a better example is like crimes, you know, crimes that happen at convenience stores or malls or public places, you know, and then you have cops who will swab the door handle of the convenience store.
And you're like, great, this is not helpful.
And you're like, okay, well, I'm going to get about 1,000 people who've touched that doorknob.
Well, how much does one sample actually cost, like going through the entire testing process?
Because you can batch things, it reduces the individual cost, but I would say per sample it's going to be around, and this might be off, but I mean it's probably going to be somewhere at least $200.
Per sample.
And that would be including, you know, paying the analyst to take the time to do everything. That might be lower. I mean, the labs that I worked in we did not have a lot of robotics because we were small enough that we were doing a lot of the work hands-on. So a lot of crime labs, like state crime labs now especially, have switched over to robots who do a lot of the extracting and the manual setup that you can automate because these kits that we sell at Promega are mostly each sample or each reaction contains the same components at the same volumes. So it's easy to make a robot that could just say, I can add 10 microliters of this liquid to every single well.
Interesting.
So
that makes sense.
So it's easy to set up a robot to do a lot of that type of task, but you would need the workflow volume to make that worth your while. So I'm trying to say that the private labs I worked at, we were not as high throughput. So when you're more high throughput, you can afford the robot that's going to crank through all the stuff. Yeah.
There, Mumu, there's another drone for you.
Yay. I love it when we can get robots involved. Are you seeing a lot more older cases or cold cases being tested or opened now that we have such advances in technology?
I think it is. My only experiences with cold cases were really when I worked in North Carolina, when I was a forensic scientist at LabCorp, and we would get an occasional cold case from the local police that would want to reopen something, and we did a fair amount of Innocence Project testing.
Well, I mean, there's all this talk of these backlogs of rape kits.
Yes.
And all these things that are just stacking up in warehouses, and there's all this press about it. And if you're saying the technology has changed, I mean, it's still not cheap, but that they can do, you know, 96 things at the same time instead of one, is the backlog going to maybe not be so bad, assuming people pay for it?
I think so. I know that a lot of it is just funding, because once you get a backlog of, we did work some cold case stuff from like Arizona, and we worked some cold case stuff from Texas that were a lot of rape kits, and from say the 80s, and they've been sitting that long, and if you figure you're already back to the 80s and you're just starting to try and process these cases, how much longer? And now that you're collecting more and more and more evidence, it's almost a losing battle, just because you can't afford to go back necessarily that far while you're still keeping up with what's coming in every day. I mean, every day you're getting more and more. I mean, I've seen what they've collected from crime scenes, and when they bring it all in, yeah, it's cushions and pillows and bed sheets from every bed. And speaking as a former analyst, I hate bed sheets. They are huge. First of all, you have to find a place to like hang it up where you can look at the whole thing, and then you need to use your UV light to try and identify stains.
And you don't want to know what you're seeing.
No.
Will you even use like hotel sheets, or do you bring your own?
I'm the least pleasant person to travel with.
You know too much, Chrissy. You know too much.
I do.
Oh, man. Well, here's a question for you. What are some common misconceptions? I mean, we talked about the CSI effect and the sort of assumption that things happen instantly. But are there other common misconceptions about DNA and forensic testing that people sort of say, oh, well, can't you do that? And you go, no, I actually, no, sorry. Try again.
I would say a lot of it is just assuming that you can get DNA off of anything. And the reality is there are a lot of PCR inhibitors. So the reaction that we rely on, you need to have, you need to be able to have the enzymes work in that reaction. And they have an optimal, reaction conditions that they need. And for example, indigo dye from genes can really mess up, because whatever's in indigo dye can really mess up your reaction. Other inhibitors like soil, people will collect soil samples, and you know, if someone is murdered outside and there's a blood stain on the ground, you would think, well, we have blood here, that should be really easy. But if it's in soil and you're trying to separate out the soil from the blood, it doesn't always clean out very well. And when you go to amplify it, you don't get a good result. So that was my biggest frustration as a forensic scientist, when, you know, you would see a sample that you would think, I know something is there, but there's just inhibitors and I can't separate out the inhibitors, and it's never going to work. Or, bones, old bones, when we would get those in. I mean, those are always tricky and degraded, and you have to be very careful about contaminating anything with your DNA, because you have healthy, intact DNA all over you. I mean, all of your cells have it. So when you're working with something that's very fragile and contains minimal amounts of degraded DNA, that was always nerve-wracking, just thinking, I really don't want my profile to come out of this. Because, you know, we all know our own profiles.
Right, so you see it coming and you go, oh no, I screwed it up.
Yeah, and you're like, oh no, I think that's what my genotype is there. And so that was, I would say, items that you would see and think, oh, I know that something is there, but it's just so hard to get at. I think that most people don't appreciate that we can't just make DNA happen anywhere.
One more thing that Mumu and I were chatting about, with DNA, and you know, you said you knew your profile, you could see it coming. If you're like, oh, I think that might be mine, we might have a problem. How do you feel about DNA and privacy and indexing, all these things? I mean, do you, as a scientist and researching DNA, do you think, oh, great, the more people in a database, the better for me? Or do you consider privacy when you're doing these things?
As a forensic scientist, I hate crime. I have a healthy hate for people who commit crime. And I know that makes me probably sound like a bad person, but that's why I got into this field, is I really wanted to put the bad guy away, as corny as that sounds. And so I am happy to test, I would be happy to put my own profile in. I mean, obviously I'm in the databases that are applicable for the places I have worked, but I would be happy to have people search my profile, because I know that my DNA shouldn't be at any crime scene, or if it is, it should be there for a logical reason. So I don't have a problem with it. I can understand people who do have a problem with it, and I do feel like we've improved or decrease dramatically the probability that there will be a match to someone who's completely innocent, just because we've now gotten to so many loci that the odds of you matching it, every single one of those loci, is so astronomical that I don't feel like it's a legitimate concern to think that you're going to be put in prison for a crime you didn't commit because it's not really your DNA somewhere.
Well, what do you think about the other argument that people have against, you know, this genome mapping for privacy's sake is that, let's say somewhere 50 years down the future, we are able to isolate this set of genes that sort of dictate whether or not you're going to be a serial killer, and we sort of take preventative steps to prevent that. Do you think that's even something
the minority
that's realistic?
Report
exactly,
effect.
It's minority report effect. Is that something that, you know, is even within the realm of possibility?
Just based on the research that we tried to do at Michigan State, even, people were trying to figure out hair color or eye color and try and be able to use someone's DNA sample and figure out what color eyes a suspect had based on their DNA sample. And just how many genes are involved in something as simple as eye color, and how many things are regular, you know, you don't necessarily need just the presence of those genes. It's like, which gene is actually turned on? Maybe a gene is a pseudogene and it's not functional. And so there's so much going on in the human genome that maybe it's naive of me to think, but it seems like something as complex as what makes a serial killer, which I think is, you know, partially genetic and could partially, and is a good portion of it related to how you were raised and social factors and things beyond, you know, nature versus nurture. So I don't think that that would be a possibility, but maybe that is naive of me.
Definitely not anytime soon. I mean, it's just too hard at this point.
Right. I would say the next big area that people are starting to talk about in forensics is called next generation sequencing, or next gen sequencing is the NGS, the abbreviation for it. And that's looking at actually, so, you know, we can say that you're an 810 at that locus, and that's all based on the fact that we have primers that are just looking, that are flanking a region, and they're just amplifying, and they're looking solely at size. And so what we can do now is we can actually sequence what is coming out of that region. And it's interesting to see now that not everyone is just TTAA repeated over and over and over again in that region. It could be that you're a complex mixture of like TTAA and then TTATs. And so it's interesting to see what is actually making up that repeat structure. So you can even get more detailed and say, I'm not just an 8, but this is the actual sequence of my genome at that region. And it's different from someone else who's also an 8. So now we can even get to the point where you can differentiate two people who may even have the exact same genotype at a region of their chromosome, but you can differentiate them based on the sequences. So that's the next step in forensics that people are looking at using. There's several problems that need to be overcome. First of all, next gen sequencing right now is, you know, probably today's technology in the 80s price-wise, you know,
astronomically expensive for what you get out of it.
Exactly. I mean, we would, you know, people, crime labs who are struggling with how can we stay afloat and keep up with the current case flow and maybe touch some of our backlog, how are we going to implement something that is that expensive? But then on top of that, next-gen sequencing creates terabytes of data files. You know, the size of the data files that you get are huge. And there's a lot of laws that govern forensics labs and the amount, the length of time, and the ways in which you have to store everything that you generate. So all the documentation, all the data that's generated, we have strict rules on, I mean, as far as things need to be backed up, things need to be stored.
So they need like terabytes and terabytes and terabytes, thousands of terabytes of space just to store this data that they may or may not use for years.
Correct. I mean, some it's like 25 years or it could be 100 years. And then you need to have it in a fireproof place where it can't be damaged by fire or flood, or secured so it can't be tampered with by anyone.
Oh gosh, what a mess.
So there's some significant hurdles in that arena that need to be overcome before we can look at this as a viable option for crime labs. So right now it's more of just a, and I don't mean to belittle academics, but it's more of a academics think this is really cool and it's really great technology, but right now it's not quite to the point where it can be mainstream enough for a forensics lab to use. So I think that's kind of like what you were asking about as far as determining if someone is a serial killer. I mean, we are definitely, and it sounds very futuristic, but we are actually getting to the point now where we can sequence someone's whole genome, which again gets back to privacy issues. I mean, that's a lot of information that you're storing about an individual. And that is the point where I think I start to get a little uncomfortable. I mean, I'm fine with you knowing my genotype at these particular loci, because that's not who I am. That's just repeat structures.
A reference point or something.
Yeah. You know, that I kind of like my genotype because
I didn't know you could like or hate your genotype. This is cool.
Well, apparently I got mocked a lot because we had to get our own profiles in grad school. That was one of the first things we did. And I'm very homozygous, so that means a lot of my loci, I'm the same from both my mom and dad, which a high level of homozygosity translates usually to inbreeding.
Ah, very nice.
So, and I was the only one from Iowa, and I got a lot of jokes about. I didn't help that my parents are from the same town in Iowa. So,
did you have to call your parents after that? Like, Mom, do you have something
can we draw the family tree?
So I did for my first project at my first job when they were trying to verify that I could do statistics calculations for paternity. They had me get samples from my parents and my sister, and they wanted me to extract everyone's DNA and then do all the calculations to prove that we were a family. So that was probably the most fun phone call I've ever had to make. I had to make several not fun phone calls to tell people results, but I got to call my parents up and say, you are my dad and you are my mom.
And you're not related.
Yes, and they were very happy to hear that.
Just in case you weren't sure, I mean, I'm still coming home for Christmas, but...
For better or for worse, I am your daughter. I was not switched at birth at the hospital.
Well, Christy, this has been wonderful. It's been really interesting to hear about these things. It's the other side of the world that most of us don't know anything about or sort of assume based on CSI what happens. So I think I speak for Mumu when I say this, and she can chime in, that this has been really interesting, and I think a lot of people will find this fascinating.
Well, I hope so.
Like our show? Find us on iTunes or at scopepodcast.com, and follow us online on Facebook and Twitter at Scope Podcast. This is Mumu Shu
and Lindsay Claiborne.
Our theme music was composed by The Copycats. Thanks for listening.